LinkedIn News.
If we were able to shift our understanding of happiness to realize that it comes from being of service in an authentic way, then what problems could we not solve? What could we not do, right? Like, we as a collective are amazing. We could absolutely take on all of these challenges and address them in meaningful ways. But if we believe that pursuing happiness comes from fulfilling only your own needs, then helping others will always be a secondary thing.
That's Stephanie Harrison. I'm Leah Smart, and this is Everyday Better. Make sure you hit that follow button to get new episodes of our podcast every week. And stay tuned for where you might be getting happiness wrong and what the research shows about how to get it right.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hey everyone, from LinkedIn News, I'm Leah Smart, and this is Everyday Better, a personal development podcast where every week I sit down with some of the world's brightest minds and bravest hearts to learn how we can improve ourselves, our relationship to others, and the world around us. If you know me and you know the show, you will not be surprised to hear that I am obsessed with the science of happiness and meaningful living. And I think a lot of people misconstrue what happiness is and how we actually achieve it. So many times we rely on outside forces to tell us what will make us happier. And our culture is full of messages that if we just had a nicer home or a better relationship or we went on more beach vacations or owned fancier clothes, blah, 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 that we'd finally be happy. But if you have ever gone down that path, and I definitely have, you know it simply doesn't work. Whatever happiness you find at the end will not last. And sometimes it doesn't come at all. So today I've got a friend and, funny enough, a former colleague, Stephanie Harrison, on the show. Stephanie worked at LinkedIn for several years after she went to UPenn to earn a master's in applied positive psychology, which is basically the science of well-being. And after getting her master's, Stephanie thought that she'd continue her education by getting a doctorate and then working in the field of academia. And then her partner, Alex, unexpectedly got really sick with a mysterious and debilitating illness.
We had no idea what was going on. We started going to doctor after doctor, desperately trying to figure out what was going on. None of them knew what was affecting him or how they could fix it. We were laughed at. We were told that it was in his head as he slowly became sicker and sicker and ultimately ended up becoming completely bedbound with a mysterious illness that really kind of destroyed his life in many ways and was a period of profound challenge for him and for me.
What followed for Stephanie was a long road of navigating the healthcare system. She eventually left her job to become Alex's full-time caretaker and advocate. And during that time, she started sketching out her own philosophy of happiness.
All of my ideas about happiness that I had learned over those first 5 years, I had a chance to try them out for myself and see if they actually worked. And I think that the experience, like the evidence, was so personally conclusive that it really has, in many ways, like turned into a gift.
The gift, as she puts it, was the opportunity to implement and witness for herself some of the most powerful principles that science tells us can lead to more contentment, to more joy, and ultimately to happiness, even in some of our darkest hours. So today I'm bringing Stephanie onto the show to talk about her philosophy of happiness, what she calls the new happy. She writes about it in her book, The New Happy, Getting Happiness Right in a World That's Got It Wrong. And in the book, she explores the ways in which many of us are stuck in what she refers to as old happy, a culture that makes us feel like we're not good enough, we're not doing enough, and that we must do everything alone. There's so much goodness here that we decided to make this one a two-part episode. So buckle in and get ready for a new way to be happy. Here's Stephanie.
I wrote this book because I have personally experienced what it's like to be very unhappy. And I think that experience is what allowed me to want to investigate and explore the true routes to happiness, not the ones that I had necessarily been told were the right ones by our society, by my culture, by all of the different influences that have affected me in my life. And so my hope with this book is that it helps people to avoid some of those mistakes that I made in my life and potentially proactively prevent them, or also help to course correct and find the fulfillment and joy that they're looking for and that they really deserve.
You said you know what it's like to be unhappy. How do you know when you're unhappy?
Oh, it's actually really hard sometimes, isn't it, to know when you're unhappy? I think that we can kind of exist in that state of unhappiness for a long time without realizing it, right? Have you ever experienced
that? Yes, absolutely. And then you wake up and go, wait a second.
Yeah, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's funny how sometimes I have to have a wake-up call to realize. So for me, my own wake-up call was a moment of lying on my bedroom floor, sobbing, thinking about all of the things that I hated about myself and my life and wondering whether I would ever be happy. But leading up to that, you know, I had probably been in that state of being for several years, if not more. So if you're kind of somebody who feels that sense of pervasive dissatisfaction or frustration, the presence of really frequent negative emotions, listlessness, feeling lost, those are all clues, I think, that we can use to gather up and say, okay, maybe something's not quite right for me right now.
And we're not talking about clinical depression. We're talking about the general sort of experience of unhappiness.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's obviously so many different challenges that we can experience with our mental health and well-being. But, you know, there are ways to be happy no matter what your mental health is like right now. There are always pathways to living a happier and a better life.
So you start, and I love how you juxtapose this, you juxtapose the new happy with the old happy. What is the old happy?
Old happy is the set of beliefs and ideas that we have about happiness in our culture. And then it's also about the institutions that spring up to reinforce that. So I think that the best way to think about this is to recognize that every culture or society has a set of values, right? Like there are certain things that are held in esteem that you are rewarded for working towards or that are celebrated. And in Western countries like the United States, our core values come from individualism, capitalism, and domination.
I want you to explain those because I know for some people that can feel like, oh, it's anti, it's like anarchy. It's not. But can you tell us about each of those things in a simplistic enough way that we can sort of see the examples of how that shows up in our lives?
So when we look at the values of this culture, which I call old happy culture, individualism teaches you that you're separate, right? But specifically that you have to do everything by yourself, that you can never ask for help, that it's in fact shameful to need help, that you should hide away any of your pain and suffering because it shows other people that you need them, that you can't handle it all on your own. So thinking about that from a really practical perspective, when was the last time that you asked for help, right? Like, when was the last time that you felt brave enough to raise your hand and say, I'm having a really hard time and I can't go any further. I need somebody to show up for me. That's pretty rare, I think, for most of us. And that's why it's so courageous to be somebody who asks for help, because it goes against that dominant value system. So then capitalism teaches us that we have to always, always be achieving. So the pursuit and the quest for achievement comes from this need that we have to keep up, that we have to constantly pursue success, always be productive, always be working. You know, if you've ever had that experience of being like, I know I don't need to work this hard, but I feel like I have to. That's a value system that you've been conditioned into. So, practical example, why do you justify self-care as being productive? Why do we justify that? Why does self-care have to be something that enables our economic contribution? It also instills in us a value of scarcity, of looking at the other people around us and thinking, well, I have to be the best. I have to continue to show how much better I am than other people. And I can do that through the reward system of what I achieve. Like there's this constant comparison, which also feeds into the domination culture, which is that our self-esteem is based upon how much better we are than other people. So our value as people is not actually in our authenticity and in our individuality. It's in, oh, I have the best job, so therefore I'm good enough. Or I have achieved this specific objective. Therefore, I'm better than others, which means that I'm worthy as a person. And so our quest for self-worth comes at the expense of other human beings. It comes from clambering on top of them and trying to prove how much better we are than they are. And so this takes the form of systemic forms of domination as well, from, you know, specifically targeting groups of people or trying to disenfranchise others, from treating people as though they have to prove their worth rather than accepting their inherent self-worth. And so these, I call them forces, these cultural forces, they feel really distant from us, right? They feel like, oh, there are these big things out there in the world. But actually, because we're conditioned into them from the days that we're born, they ultimately end up really instilling these core values in us, which then tell us you're not good enough, that you have to achieve more and more and more, and you have to do everything by yourself.
You talk about how there are a number of statements that kind of tell you you're in the old happy paradigm. One is like, I am not enough, or it's not good enough. It's things that like go on in our heads that we may not even consciously realize are happening.
Yeah, I think that most of us have an inner monologue that's going most of the time. It's one of the reasons why I think cultivating self-awareness, which I know is something that you're so passionate about and teach so frequently, is really important, because with that awareness, we can start to identify, hey, maybe there's something going on inside of me that needs attending to. Like, I remember having this instinct of being like, well, my life is ruined, so I just have to start over in some way. Like, as though everything had to be absolutely perfect in order to be happy. And I think that the more that we can start to notice those thoughts and also the behaviors that go along with them, the more we can start to attend to our, you know, our true goal, which is the pursuit of happiness and well-being.
You talk about this inner monologue, and I will say I have spoken to people who don't even realize, and I, for the longest time until I started meditating, didn't realize I had an inner monologue or inner dialogue.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I didn't realize until I started practicing meditation. It was a revelation for me to be like, there's a voice in my head.
Someone called it your inner roommate. I was like, that is the perfect thing, because roommates are so annoying.
Yeah. And so it was really learning, okay, there's me and then there's that voice, and those two things are not the same. I think that's really where the power of meditation comes from for most of us. It's cultivating that meta awareness of, here's how I'm feeling, or here's what I'm needing right now, and learning to tap into those inner states that can feel so inaccessible without cultivating that sort of strength.
So you said in the book that there are three important questions that you have to ask yourself, which are, who am I? What should I do? And how am I related to others? Can you talk about each of those questions and why they're so important?
Yeah. So I think that those three questions make up this whole schema of our consciousness. The first one is about our identity. So who are you as a person? It's kind of the ultimate question in many ways. And if you think about it, most of us define who we are based upon what society tells us we are. We're constantly getting these messages telling us who we're supposed to be. So it's really easy to lose sight of who we truly are. So that's the first question. The second, what should I do? Another big question, what should I do with my life? How should I live? What should I do for work? That's one of the biggest questions that we can answer in our lives. And then the third question, which I think is one of the ones that's most often missed and actually the most important, is how am I related to others? And when we think about who we are in the world, do we see ourselves as individual islands existing alone, disconnected from other people? Or do we see ourselves as part of a broader web of interconnectedness, of relationships, of mutuality and compassion and connection? And that actually has a profound impact upon our happiness. And so these three questions are at the heart of everything that we do.
So you answer each of these questions from the old happy perspective. So who am I? The answer, if you're in the old happy, is I am lacking something. What should I do? The answer is I must achieve expected outcomes. And then how am I related to others? I am separate from others. And the third question was the most surprising to me, because I realized that my answer was tied into the answers you talk about in the old happy paradigm. And as much as I got to be honest, I love this work and I do it, that is a deep and inherent feeling.
It is. And it's because of our individualistic culture, right? We're socialized into believing that we're separate from one another and that, you know, you and I are completely unique and we have nothing in common unless we hunt it down and find it and cultivate a relationship. And this this culture of individualism has taught us to essentially discard our inherent connections to one another and to the natural world around us. And we're seeing the negative impacts upon that on our mental health, on our state of loneliness, on the way that we respond to the problems in our country and in our world, the way that we're responding to climate change. And this belief that we are separate ends up underpinning so much of our suffering.
So for someone who's listening to this right now and going, well, what do you mean? I am separate. What would you say?
You are your own unique individual. You have your own thoughts and feelings. You have your own desires and dreams. All of that is true. And at the same time, nothing that you do exists alone from other people. You woke up today and ate breakfast that was brought to you in some way or another by your fellow human beings. You drove down a road that was paved by somebody. You went to an office at a company that was started by another person to work with coworkers. And you're listening to a podcast that was created by other people. And you're taking something away from it, hopefully, fingers crossed. So how could we ever see ourselves as separate when our entire lives are enabled by the efforts of other people who are contributing something, whether they know it or not?
Mm-hmm. So this idea of the old happy, these statements that we make in our minds, can feel so natural. And it really is a cycle, right? And as long as you're around people who basically think and feel like you, for the most part, you will not end up making a big shift unless something happens. So I'm reminded, as you're talking about this, about someone named Robert Keegan, who is a Harvard professor, does research on adult development. And he talks about the fact that most people are in what he calls the socialized mind. It's about 65% of the population. It means that we get our values from the outside, we bring them inside, and we live with those values. Then there's sort of a next door neighbor to that that happens oftentimes when people have an event in their life, something unexpected, right? You get a divorce, you have a miscarriage, you lose your job, you lose your home. I mean, any of the things that can happen that completely knock you off course. And what he talks about is the fact that oftentimes that can send you into what they call the self-authoring mind, which is where you start to come up with your own ideas and values around what it means to live, because the old stuff doesn't work, because you've now sort of like, it's kind of like the Matrix in a way, like you've broken the mold, right? It's like you've taken the pill and now you see it all. And that is, to me, I mean, I've had my own experience of that. And I also know from reading your book, you talk about your personal experience that got you here. Can you tell us your story and how you ended up developing this philosophy around the new happy?
Yeah, you know, it really began when I was in my early 20s and I had this fancy job that was just not the right fit for me, and was feeling incredibly sad and lonely all the time. I started having panic attacks and not being able to sleep and having physical symptoms of illness, like a full body rash and an autoimmune disease that came out of nowhere. It was sort of like getting slammed with a whole bunch of those signals that we were talking about earlier in terms of, hey, something might be wrong here. And that's when I decided that what I thought I was doing to be happy must be wrong. It was breaking free of those narratives that I had been so deeply conditioned into that I honestly didn't even know that they were not the truth and not the reality. And then I sort of went on this journey for a few years trying to figure out where I had gone wrong. That's when I got my graduate degree and studied positive psychology. And so I formed this hypothesis, this, you know, beginning of this philosophy. And then my partner got really sick and it came out of nowhere. We had no idea what was going on. We started going to doctor after doctor, you know, just constantly, desperately trying to figure out what was going on. None of them knew what was affecting him or how they could fix it. We were laughed at. We were told that it was in his head as he slowly became sicker and sicker and ultimately ended up becoming completely bedbound with a mysterious illness that really kind of destroyed his life in many ways and was a period of profound challenge for him and for me. And I had originally planned on going to get a doctorate. And then when he got sick, that became something that wasn't possible. And so I ended up leaving my job to become his full-time caregiver and to be there to help try and solve this medical mystery. And what I learned from the experience with him and what we went through was that all of my ideas about happiness that I had learned over those first 5 years, I had a chance to try them out for myself and see if they actually worked. And it was it was amazing to me because even in that period of profound suffering, I was able to experience and access more joy and more fulfillment than I had when I was living in New York and my life was, by all other external measures, great and perfect and wonderful and exciting and successful. So it was sort of like I had the chance to learn it academically, but then the universe gave me this chance to put it to the test in this way. And the evidence was so personally conclusive and life-changing that it really gave me the confidence and the purpose to want to start sharing it with other people as well and seeing if it would work for them.
After the break, Stephanie shares her philosophy on happiness and shows us how to get there ourselves. But before we can do that, we have to unravel old happy. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hey you, I'm Andrew Seaman. Do you want a new job? Or do you want to move forward in your career? Well, you should listen to my weekly show called Get Hired with Andrew Seaman. We talk about it all, and it's waiting for you, yes you, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with Stephanie Harrison, author of The New Happy. So tell me about The New Happy. And what I love that you share in the philosophy piece is what you're really talking about is a way of living.
The New Happy philosophy is about choosing consciously a new way to pursue happiness with the goal of not only contributing to your own personal happiness, but to the happiness of the broader world. And I found through my research and through the studies I've read, the books, the people I've spoken to, there were these two messages that came through over and over and over again, and I saw them everywhere. And those are the two core pillars of what the New Happy philosophy is about. And the first one is that you need to be who you really are. And the second is you need to share yourself with others in the hopes of making their lives better.
This first point of be who you really are and that question of who am I? I think sometimes this conversation of uniqueness and authenticity can actually go too far in the sense that it almost gets like commercialized or idolized.
Yeah.
And so when you say be who you really are and when you use the term authentic, what do you mean?
So your true self is innately good. Your true self is loving, compassionate, kind, and connected to people. So that's how I define the true self. But I think to what you're talking about, that's not how a lot of other people define one's true authentic self. Because again, a lot gets warped by old happy. So if you're operating in an old happy world and you're pursuing authenticity, then it becomes, how can I be better than everybody else and gain the most acclaim and power and fortune and popularity and all that kind of stuff? And as you said, like commercialize my individualism, my authenticity in some way. And that is a very, very different thing. Authenticity can also become a shield for I won't change. This is who I am. I don't have to do anything else for anyone else because I'm doing me.
So when it comes to connecting to who we really are, do you have a favorite practice for that?
You know, it's so funny because I think that the best way to connect to who you really are is to stop thinking about yourself. Like, right? Like,
yeah.
That's sort of the paradox at the heart of this.
Well, what do you mean?
Think about a time that you did something to help somebody and how you felt afterwards. You probably felt a sense of contentment and peace and pride in yourself, and you felt a sense of like wholeness, I would imagine. You probably felt more expansive, like wider, but not taller, which is kind of like a paradigm that I think is really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I feel when I help people. By doing that, you end up tapping into the sense of like inner peace and connectedness, right? I don't know. What's your experience? Does that resonate with you?
Yes. Random, but I went to a high school musical.
Yeah.
And the high school is a public school and they have to raise money for their musicals. And it was so beautiful. It was like, you know, I was crying before the end of it. I was crying. And I never carry cash, but they were like, we need support, you know, as we do this. And I go to a lot of theater. So I watch a lot of adults who've been able to create this dream for themselves to be able to be on Broadway. And so then to watch these kids who are sophomores, juniors, seniors in high school, same dream, I wanted to close the gap, you know, and part of closing that gap is helping them have resources. So I just like found the money in my purse that I had. And I was like, I'm just giving it. Like, I don't care. And it felt so good. It was this moment where I was like, I don't need this. And you guys do. And yeah, I love wider, not taller, because that's how it felt.
When you just tell me that story about you helping somebody who I have never met before, I wasn't there at the show, I didn't witness it, and I have full body goosebumps and I want to cry because of your act of kindness and compassion. Like,
yeah,
that is who you are. That's who you are, right? Like in that moment, that's your true self.
So talk to me about sharing yourself with others, because I think in this world where like social media rules so many of our lives, we make up immediately that that has to do with that, or it has to be in some big way that feels important. What's the real way we share ourselves with others?
It's really through our daily interactions, right? It's calling your friend who you know is going through something hard. It's saying thank you to somebody who helps you. It's holding the door for another person. It's these small little moments in our daily lives that we take so for granted, and that the more that we can decorate our lives with them, the more joy we can experience in every day. It really comes back to what we were talking about with the individualism and the collectivism, right? You can be your true self and your authentic self, but if you're not going to the next step of sharing yourself with others, then you're only taking it halfway. You're missing out on half of the happiness, let's say, or the expansive opportunities that you have for meaning and fulfillment and purpose in your life. So the beauty, I hope, of this approach is that when you devote yourself, your true self, to helping other people, you're not just creating your own happiness. You're creating happiness for the whole world, because we have so many problems that we're facing in our world right now. And it can feel completely overwhelming and paralyzing and terrifying to contemplate how we will ever, ever make a difference towards solving them. But if we were able to shift our understanding of happiness to realize that it comes from this form of being of service in an authentic way, then what problems could we not solve? What could we not do, right? Like, we as a collective are amazing. We have so much to offer. We could absolutely take on all of these challenges and address them in meaningful ways. But what stands in the way is our misguided definition of happiness, because if we believe that pursuing happiness comes from fulfilling only your own needs, then helping others will always be a secondary thing.
So one thing you talk about is that some of the ideas in the book don't merely run counter to what we've been taught. They're ones that the powers of our society don't want us to even think about. I'm curious for you, what was the hardest thing to accept when you consider these things as you were researching and putting these things into practice?
I would have to say that it's probably the one that most of us struggle with, which is the sense of not being good enough. Believing that I wasn't enough unless I did A, B, and C and did them all perfectly and never asked for help with any of them. And so for me, the worthiness one has definitely been the hardest one to keep in mind as I navigate my own life. Because as you said, like for years, you just bathe in it. You're like swimming in that message of you're not good enough. And again, our capitalist society does not want me to believe I'm good enough, because then I'm not going to go out and buy a bunch of stuff to feel better about myself.
Right.
Then I'm going to disconnect from consumerism and materialism, and that's not going to help the economy. It's way, way better if I constantly feel like I'm worthless and that I can purchase my worth through the next big product that I see. So letting go of that. And I still have to shake it off like on a regular basis. And I think that it's probably not going to be possible for us living in the old happy world that we have right now to be able to shake off old happy entirely. The way that we can do that is by making a new world. But in the meantime, I always have this image of like a dog, a wet dog, like shaking off the rain or whatever, right? Like it's going to happen. Like you're going to get rained on, and you just have to kind of do your, hey, I'm affected by old happy. Like this is something that's going on within me. I am worthy. The feeling that I'm getting right now isn't something that's true. I just have to remember that. And then we just have to like kind of keep that as a practice.
Yeah, which is so hard. I mean, I definitely did that for most of my 20s. And I will say, I'll add, you know, I do want to talk more about this. Some of the systems we live within, and depending on who you are in that system, can drive that consumerism, drive that idea of buying your worth. So, you know, I know as a Black child growing up around mostly people who were white, I remember this feeling as a child of not being enough.
Yeah.
And having to work so hard because as a kid and as a teenager and even as a young adult, you're just trying to survive. You're trying to fit in, you know? So it's a lot of that. And I certainly was overspending and making sure that I could say I was enough by what I was wearing and how my hair looked and what trip I had gone on. And you find out that, like, nobody cares. They care for 5 seconds, and then it's the wafiest thing you can do is buy your way into this.
Well, you bring up such an important point, which is that old happy harms the people with less privilege in whatever intersectional way that you're defining that. And so there have been many studies that have found that our consumerist culture has a bigger impact upon Black children, just like as you're talking about, because it's this lie that's presented as like, here's a way to participate in our fundamentally broken society. And it offers you this pathway that makes it feel like, okay, I can be acceptable in this way.
Yep.
And then as you're saying, like, you do it and it doesn't pan out and you're left wondering, well, there must be something wrong with me.
Yes.
Right?
I love you calling that out. And I'm excited to talk more with you about that because it is something we can't ignore when we think about, like, how do people find happiness and meaning? And that it's possible that no matter who you are and where you sit in this kind of paradigm or the socioeconomic construct, that you can actually find happiness too. Yeah. So, Stephanie, talk to me about some of the ways that we can combat the old happy.
The biggest strategy that I always recommend is just start naming it. Start calling it out when you see it, because that's what helps you to separate it from you. So realizing, like, no, there's nothing wrong with you. And anything that's telling you that is an old happy message at the end of the day. Anyone who's telling you that you're not acceptable until you do A, B, and C, or that you're not worthy because of X, Y, and Z, that's just garbage. And the more that you can name that for what it is, the better. And that's ultimately why I ended up giving it the name, because I wanted people to have something that they could use. To your point, these forces and the conditioning, they're invisible. So let's make them visible. Let's call it out when we see it. So that's always the first thing that I recommend. And then in terms of helping to address the three core questions, the three lies of old happy, the first one is recognizing your inherent worth as a person. And there's so many different ways to do that. One of my favorite ones is, like, if you loved yourself and accepted yourself 100% completely, what would you do right now? And I use that question a lot with myself, and it's been really helpful. Like, let's say I make a mistake at work and I'm having a really hard time. I'll ask myself, okay, what would I do if I fully accepted and loved myself? Because I think that we can act ourselves into this new relationship with ourselves. And by taking those actions and showing ourselves, hey, like, I'm here for you and here are the ways that I'm showing up, we can start to build that and cultivate that.
I particularly love that because it hits on, like, creating objectivity in the sense that, like, it doesn't rely on how you feel about yourself in the moment. It relies on, like, you know, like, you might be like, I am so pissed at myself for whatever reason.
Totally.
If I love myself completely, like, hypothetically, you know, you can be more objective.
The second is starting to identify what you're doing with your days, with your life, with your work, and then asking, is this actually what I really want? Like, is this really aligned with me? And you might discover, you probably, to be honest, will discover that the answer is no. Like, you're doing some stuff that doesn't feel aligned to your true self. And that's okay, because once you know, you can start to make changes. And again, I always want to tell people to start small, asking, what's one thing I can do today that would make me feel alive or excited or energized? And then go do it and see what happens next. You know, like, everything good in my own life came from asking myself that question. And then the third is starting to look for your connections with other people and the ways in which you are related to them. And so that can be as simple as doing something nice for somebody and trying to make that a priority in your daily life, like doing a favor for a friend or helping out a stranger that you see on the street. Any moments of connection where you can feel like you're making a difference for somebody are going to help you to instantly feel connected. So if you can apply those three very little strategies in your day, you're going to actually be unwinding old happy while also moving towards happiness.
So I wonder, as someone who may be thinking about this and critiquing your idea of the new happy philosophy, there's two questions I have. One is, if we adopt the new happy philosophy, do we run the risk of ignoring some of our shortcomings? For example, by saying, I accept myself completely And then the second is, I can imagine that there are people who are listening who hear this and they go, that just sounds like a bunch of BS. That's like the soft life. What do you say to those people who are finding fault in doing this?
So to the first point, I would say, I would love for you to think about a time when you felt really criticized by somebody and how you responded. And I'll tell you about what happens when I feel criticized. I feel very defensive and I lash out. I think, oh my God, like, how dare they? They don't know me at all. You're the problem. It's your fault. And here's all the reasons why. That's how I respond to really critical feedback that I get externally. So why would I think that I would respond any better to inner critical feedback? Why would I think that beating myself up would help me to hear what's really being said or what's being offered and then make changes? Then I would contrast that with thinking about a time when somebody gave you constructive feedback that was delivered with care and how much easier it was for you to really listen to them. And if you don't buy that, there are studies that have found that the more critical you are, the less likely you are to actually persist with a goal. You're more likely to give up the more you criticize yourself. So what I always tell people is, you're not persisting because of the criticism. You're actually persisting in spite of the criticism. That's how strong you are. But it would be a lot easier if you switch to accepting yourself first. And I don't know if that's convincing for people, but I always say, like, don't listen to me. Go try it.
Yes.
You know, go see how it goes for you. And if it works for you, fantastic. And if it doesn't, that's okay too. But it might be worth a try. And yeah, criticism might work in the short term. It might motivate you a little bit in the short term. But at what cost? At what cost on your mental health? At what cost on your relationships? On what cost to your physical and your emotional well-being? Like, that is something that I think there are so many people who are having to deal with this challenge of, wow, I've treated myself terribly for the last 30 years, and now I have to unwind all of those behaviors and try and learn a new way of relating to myself. What if we could just avoid that and just start from a sense of acceptance and of recognizing that, yeah, you're worthy. And also you're imperfect. Of course you are. You're both. Like, we have to hold both of those ideas at the same time.
And what about for people who are like, I hate personal development. I hate self-help. This is like a wafy, like soft conversation. Just get over yourself and go live.
I would say that the work I do is not self-help. It's about other help. It's about, how do we ensure well-being for all of the humans and creatures and our entire planet? I can't think of anything more important than that. So I would say to anyone who thinks it's soft, how could it be soft to ensure that the people in your life and in the world live good lives where they make a difference and where they hopefully make that world a better place? To me, that feels like the ultimate problem. So I understand other people won't feel that way, but at the end of the day, everything that we're doing is in some way trying to advance our well-being as a society. So, like, let's be overt about it and call it for what it is.
I love that response. Mine would be like, who hurt you? That'd be mine. Stephanie, I can't wait to have you back. We're going to talk about getting to the new happy, so really going deep into this. And then we're going to talk about sharing the new happy, because as you said, we can't do this unless we both become our true selves and then go out into the world and share it. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to you. It's such a joy.
That was Stephanie Harrison, author of The New Happy, Getting Happiness Right in a World That's Got It Wrong. And she's the artist behind The New Happy on social media. Stephanie's going to be back with us next week, so make sure you come right back here for how we keep unraveling ourselves from that old happy paradigm and implement her research-backed new happy philosophy. If this conversation resonated with you, share it with the first person who comes to mind. You never know how it could help them out. And support other people like you in finding our show by leaving us a rating before you go. While you're at it, write a one-sentence review telling me and the team what you love about Everyday Better. And as always, you can get me in your inbox by signing up for our weekly personal development newsletter, giving you practical tips on how to level up with small steps every day. You can get to it pretty easily in our show notes for this week's episode. But if you've got your browser open, you can also find it at linkedin.com/everydaybetter. That's linkedin.com/everydaybetter. Everyday Better is a production of LinkedIn News,
the Show is produced by Alexis Randall. Our associate producer is Grace Rubin. Asaf Gaudron is our sound engineer. He makes sure we sound good in the studio. Joe DiGiorgi mixed our show. Enrique Montalvo is the executive producer of LinkedIn Editorial Productions. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Coop is head of LinkedIn Original Audio and Video. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. And I'm Leah Smart. Thanks for coming with me, and I'll see you next week.